matter and is likely to take months. The U.S. passed a bill Wednesday to make the Pulse nightclub in Orlando a national memorial. The bill's passage comes just days before the fifth anniversary of the June 12, 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting that left 50 people dead and dozens were wounded. The bill passed the House in May and now heads to President Biden's desk for a signature. A nonprofit established by the owner of Pulse will be in charge of running the memorial. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 84 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 78, mostly cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
And it's 12 noon in New York City. Coming up next, The Gary Null Show.
From New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a special presentation. I would suggest that if you have friends that you care about their health, who are confused about whether to vaccinate or not, whether to take one of the drugs or not, where they're simply sick and relying exclusively upon the doctor's input for their treatment, without question, they may find this program empowering and enlightening. Today, I'm going to do an original, in-depth commentary looking at all of medicine and all of science. I'm in a rather unique position to do that because for more than 55 years, I've been helping people make decisions about healthier choices. Being able to show people what exercise, stress management, positive attitude, understanding that the basis of life is an understanding of who we are and how we can be in service to other people, and then sharing that with as many people as possible in different forms. But one thing has been true during my entire career and all of the thousands of people I've been privileged to meet, Linus Pauling, Rene Dubos, Buckminster Fuller, George Borgstrom, Linus Pauling, Pearl Buck, Norman Mailer, thousands of individuals who, for a moment in time, allowed us to better understand the meanings of life through their interpretations. I've also seen a rather unique phenomena that through my entire career, those who have done the best to help people using natural non-toxic techniques have had to apologize, in effect, to be extraordinarily humble and self-effacing, never taking credit for what they've done as a chiropractor, a homeopath, a naturopath, a holistic dentist, nurse, dietitian, or nutritionist. Because we were always led to believe that we are misinformed, we are pseudoscience, we are quacks and charlatans and frauds. Our only motive would be one of fame and money. And who said this? It began with one person, a quackbuster who had no expertise in any of this. Tear it down, destroy reputations, but never once sitting in an office seeing someone who is near death, and then 6 months later seeing that person alive and well, and 2 years later completely free of their terminal illness. Never once the people who criticize the alternative field have been in our shoes. Never once have they achieved what we have. That's the irony. Anthony Fauci, all the members of the scientific community, all the doctors in the world, all of the public health agencies, all of the hundreds of billions of dollars spent, and they have yet to show me one person who was cured by their techniques. And I have 18 cured, proven, and 1,200 who had no diseases whatsoever after treatment, but were still HIV positive. They refuse to acknowledge this. They refuse to acknowledge all of the 2,000 plus holistic medical doctors their colleagues went to their medical schools and at some point realized that the model they were using was not working and therefore chose a more humanistic and natural approach and succeeded. Not one of those people were ever acclaimed or rewarded with public acknowledgement that you did it right, because it would have shown how many were doing it wrong. We all see the commercials of how important new technology is to helping with cancer diagnosis and treatment and the latest in stem cell research. And so people, 99% of all people, go to those hospitals and doctors. They get the surgery, which I support, radiation and chemotherapy, and many of them die. Over half die. Why is it you've never seen a commercial showing the medical bill that the family receives at the end of that treatment? Why don't you see the person suffering? Why don't you see all the tens of thousands of children suffering from cancer and pediatric cancer wards? Why don't you then look at the bank balances of Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, and look at the prestige of being in a field where no matter how many times you fail, no matter how many times patients die, you're still rewarded. What a unique concept. So today I'm taking them all on, but I'm doing it differently. I'm going to begin. I'm saving my commentary for after this. I'm going to show you a series of television programs from India. Only one is from Australia. These are short, but they all have something in common. They're willing to tell the truth about the origins of COVID, where no American media has taken this on at all. To the contrary, all of the talking heads on MSNBC, CBS, ABC, The New York Times, Washington Post, they all, including all of the major platforms in Silicon Valley, have defended Anthony Fauci, have praised him as if he's a new godlike figure, when he's an extraordinarily flawed human being who's caused so much suffering and death and has profited from it. Ask yourself, if these individuals, these journalists, these scientists, these physicians in India could find the truth, why couldn't anyone in our medical community or our scientific community or our bureaucratic community do the same? You're going to hear some remarkable information, including patenting a COVID vaccine in China before the epidemic began. How do you do that? How do you find a treatment before it's been acknowledged you have a problem that needs treating? You're going to find that the very first journal in the world to show that it was the Wuhan lab where the coronavirus originated was from a group of Indian scientists. It was published and immediately it was pulled out of publication. Now these people, through Anthony Fauci's emails, found out it was Anthony Fauci who was the architect and lead provocateur of getting that article rescinded. Why did he do that? That's not the role of scientists, to condemn without discussion, without review, without debate, without an honest dialogue. Yet he chose none of the above. With the American media holding him accountable, you're going to hear things you've never heard before on today's program. We begin by going to our first clip. And this is, we're going to go right down the line. They're all short, but these are the best of the journalists in India, a country of nearly 1.4 billion individuals, and some of the finest scientists, some of the finest healing modalities, including Ayurvedic medicine, in the world. You wouldn't know any of this by watching any of the American media. Now to our first clip.
Brings us to the story we've been bringing you since last year, the lab leak theory. For more than a year now, we've been reporting on this. For almost a month now, the world has been waking up to it. There is growing circumstantial evidence against the Wuhan lab in China and growing consensus on why it needs to be investigated further. American intelligence officials are investigating. It is believed that this lab was conducting risky research into bat coronaviruses. And this is not the first such case. Viruses have leaked from Chinese labs in the past, so the lab leak theory cannot be dismissed just yet. But let's take it one step further. Have you ever wondered how many such laboratories exist in China? How many such facilities are there in the world? Such labs that conduct dangerous experiments with viruses? What's the possibility of another deadly virus leaking from another lab? Why do these labs exist? How safe are we from lab leaks? Over the past few days, we did some research, we spoke to some experts and also found some assessments, and we can tell you that the results paint a rather scary picture. The Wuhan lab is not an exception. There are several such labs in the world, they are in urban centers and they're prone to leaks. Let me show you something. Look carefully at this map. Our world today has as many as 59 such laboratories, 59. And this list includes labs that are currently operational, the ones that are under construction, and the projects that are still in the planning stage. 59 of them, they're spread across 23 countries. Here's a breakdown. The largest concentration of such labs is in Europe. They have 25 of them. In these countries, Belarus, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, Hungary, Italy, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United Kingdom. Russia, too, has one such lab. The next major concentration is in North America. This region has 14 laboratories. They're split between the US and Canada. The United States has 12 labs. Canada has 2. Asia has 13 labs in all. They're in China, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and Taiwan. China has 3 of them. India, too, has 3 such labs. What about West Asia? Only one such lab in West Asia. It's in Saudi Arabia. Australia has 4 labs. Africa has 3 labs. One each in South Africa, Gabon, and Côte d'Ivoire. So no major region is without a high-security lab, a quote-unquote high-security lab. These are Biosafety Level 4 labs, also called BSL4, Biosafety Level 4. This is the highest security classification, Level 4. It means that these labs can be used to study dangerous viruses and pathogens, disease-causing organisms. But here's a question. Are these labs equipped to handle dangerous research? Do they have the safety standards in place to ensure such viruses do not leak? Who is regulating them? Do they all follow similar safety protocols? The short answer to all these questions is no. And scientists are raising red flags, have been raising red flags for a while. There are 3 clear reasons why scientists the world over are worried. Number one, security is a problem in most of these laboratories. Number two, most of these labs are in urban centers, in highly populated areas. And number three, most countries do not have clear laws to regulate risky research. Let's take them one by one. First of all, security. Look at this assessment on your screen. It is by non-profit Nuclear Threat Initiative. And this is what it says. Only 6 countries out of the 23 that we just mentioned, only 6 countries have high levels of biosafety preparedness. 6 out of 23. These labs are the most secure. These include countries like the United States and the United Kingdom. Then we have labs in 11 countries which have, quote unquote, a medium rating. This means a lax or weak security arrangement. Chinese labs are in this category. And then we have 5 countries with low levels of security. This list includes South Africa. So security is a concern. The second issue is the location of such laboratories. They're in urban centers. And they could directly put large populations at risk. 75% of all labs in the world are located in urban centers, which means higher risk of infection traveling wider. It also means a large number of people may get infected in case of a leak. Problem number 3, regulation or the lack of it. Just 3 out of 23 countries that host these high security labs have serious oversight. Let me explain this. A big concern is the military use of highly secure labs. Are they only doing research or are they creating potential bioweapons? Who is going to check this? Just 3 countries have oversight on research and its potential military use. They have laws which regulate research and its potential use for making weapons. Which are these countries? Again, the United States and the United Kingdom are 2 of them. The European Union also has specific laws in place. What about the rest? There is little clarity on regulation in the other countries on this list. So is there any global rule book any international law that dictates the rules for the safety of these labs. Yes, technically there is. All countries with BSL-4 labs, biosafety level 4 labs, have international obligations to follow. Now, 22 of these countries must comply with the Biological Weapons Convention. The 23rd on the list is Taiwan. It is not internationally recognized as a country, so it is not part of this list. Now, the Biological Weapons Convention bans the development and possession of biological weapons. Under this treaty, countries must self-declare their biosafety and biosecurity laws. They must self-report information about laboratories. It sounds like the most effective framework ever. Countries self-declaring, don't they always do so? Don't they always come clean on their virus research and lab leaks? The current regulatory framework is as good as none. It offers no guarantee that safety standards and best practices are being followed anywhere in the world. What does all of this tell you? Another lab leak is very much a possibility. And we have everything in place to ensure that. And this is not a hypothetical threat of bioweapons. Look at some instances in the past. In 2001, an attacker killed 5 people by sending anthrax through mail in the United States. And it is believed that this anthrax was stolen from a laboratory. More recent lab escapes have come from China. In the year 2004, 9 people were infected with SARS. This is after 2 researchers in Beijing were exposed to it. They were working on the SARS virus inside a lab. One person even died due to this accidental leak. And then in November 2019, just before the beginning of this pandemic, 6,000 people were infected with brucellosis. That's after a leak at a vaccine plant in northwestern China. Now, despite all these security concerns, China is still aggressively pursuing more such labs. Last month, China's Guangdong province announced plans to build 25 to 30 level 3 labs. This is one province. 25 to 30 level 3 labs and one top level BSL lab, the high security lab, in the next 5 years. It seems one leaky lab in Wuhan is not enough. One province in China wants more than 30 new labs. We often talk about an arms race, we talk about a nuclear race, but look at this. Such labs pose a major risk to the safety and security of all humankind, and despite this pandemic, governments have shown no urgency to address these risks. So here's the question we began.
Okay, so what did we learn? We learned that there are labs all over the world. We learned that these labs regularly, on a routine basis, including the United States, and especially the United States, have leaks on a regular basis. We also know that some of these leaks come from stage four labs, our highest security labs. The question is, why have we not banned completely gain-of-function research? Anthony Fauci actually stated that if there was a situation where it was either do the gain of research, function research, and have the possibility of it leaking out, he said it's worth it. To whom is it worth? Not to the persons who are sickened or died, not to economies closed down, and not to people living in constant fear. More children have killed themselves than have died from COVID, yet you wouldn't know that from the mainstream media, government agencies, including those who are supervising this. That should tell you how corrupt the system is, and she just highlighted that. None of what she just said will you see in any of the mainstream media. We don't want to talk about it because too many people are making too much money and there's too much power at stake here. Let's go to the next.
Well, there is more damning proof of coronavirus originating from a lab in Wuhan in China, the Wuhan Virology Lab. India Today has accessed an exclusive video of Peter Daszak, member of the WHO International Expert Group and president of the Eco Health Alliance. In this video, Daszak is boasting about the manipulation of the killer SARS-like coronaviruses carried out by his colleagues in China. He's made the admission at this forum discussing emerging infectious diseases and the next pandemic. He is heard describing the process of inserting spike proteins into viruses to see if they can bind to human cells, emphasizing that the trials are being carried out by his colleagues in China. It follows growing proof of Wuhan Virology Lab's deep financial and personal ties to Biden's top advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The WHO expert controlled EcoHealth Alliance was one of the primary proxies funneling the money to the Chinese lab in Wuhan.
Then when you get a sequence of a virus and it looks like a relative of a known nasty pathogen, just like we did with SARS, we found other coronaviruses in bats, a whole host of them. Some of them looked very similar to SARS. So we sequenced the spike protein, the protein that attaches to cells. Then we, well, I didn't do this work, but my colleagues in China did the work. You create pseudoparticles, you insert the spike proteins from those viruses, see if they bind to human cells. And each step of this, you move closer and closer to this virus could really become pathogenic in people. So you narrow down the field, you reduce the cost, and you end up with a small number of viruses that really do look like killers.
Well, China's role in designing...
Keep in mind, you just heard Peter Daszak, who was chosen by the World Health Organization, which is controlled by China and Bill Gates. And Bill Gates just received a membership in a national academy in China and is the second major funder of the World Health Organization and the primary funder of Gavi, which I'll deal with on an upcoming program. And he was the front person to go to China, spent a few hours at the Wuhan lab and said nothing to see here and came back. Now, you heard him say in his own words that the gain-of-function research he did on the SARS vaccine, that was the second time I've heard him say something like this. Another time was a sit-down interview at an international symposium in Hong Kong, and he said the same thing. Now, he said he was clear to say, well, I didn't do this, but he funded it. We have now shown over $200 million going to him through the Defense Department and through other agencies and then through Anthony Fauci, through the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. Then he gives it to North Carolina researchers and to Wuhan. He is also on campus in both places. So when Anthony Fauci says, we never funded this, we've never done this, he's lying. Why isn't he held accountable? Why isn't he held accountable for perjury before Congress under oath? We have absolute irrefutable proof that we've been funding this. Fauci's been funding this, and this was his lead person. He is also in Fauci's emails. So what amount of proof do you need? And yet the suck-ups within the mainstream media, they will defend Fauci. Let's go to another one.
Broke a story of how IIT researchers, Indian researchers and scientists were the first, perhaps in the world, in January 2020 when they exposed the truth about coronavirus, when they said that it is unusual, it doesn't seem like it's natural, or they spoke of how in their detailed research paper, after an investigation, they spoke of how four specific inserts were found in samples of COVID-19 from Wuhan, which were not found in any coronavirus in the database back then. We spoke about this IIT researchers report that was put up and later forced to take down. They were forced to take it down after they were attacked, cyberbullied, they were trolled. And the Republic TV news break is getting bigger. It appears Dr. Anthony Fauci, internal mails of Dr. Anthony Fauci show that he attacked the research paper that was conducted, that was done by the team of researchers in the national capital. And we have an email where Dr. Anthony Fauci in February 2020, while referring to this paper that was put out by IIT researchers, he called it outlandish. He called the Indian report outlandish. Today, the whole world is talking about this Indian report, which was first put out after scientific research in January 2020. We'll put the graphics out of that as well. But the big news is that we broke the story earlier today, and it appears Dr. Anthony Fauci also tried to discredit our IIT scientists and researchers in February 2020.
Okay. You've not heard that before. It's played nowhere in the American media. You're hearing it exclusively today on this program. Anthony Fauci, who should be tried on crimes against humanity and spend the rest of his life in prison, along with all the other associates and a lot of journalists for supporting this knowingly, they had an accurate, honest, in-depth scientific report showing that when they studied the genome of the cells, they found that it did not match anything that found in nature. Therefore, it was a human-derived. Instead of saying, let's take a careful look at this, which other scientists, including Luc Montagnier, the Institute Pasteur, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV, he also said that it wasn't human-made, couldn't have been. And he also found, and others have found, elements of HIV in this. Why isn't that discussed? How did HIV end up in there? Someone put it in there. Why would they do that? Who did it? When was it done? But that should be an open-ended dialogue with scientists who are investigating it, who have no connections to the financing or the protection of the current dynamic around COVID. Anthony Fauci immediately attacked it. We didn't know he attacked it. Now we find out that he was the one leading the charge with no discussion, no dialogue with the scientists in India, nothing. Just on a personal level, he said, this is wrong. What was wrong about it? Now it's being shown that everything Anthony Fauci said about this was wrong, and yet he hasn't been yet called out. So there's the truth. It was Anthony Fauci again, but only because of the emails being open to the public do we know this. We have another one now.
This big story coming in from as far as the Wuhan investigation is concerned. The focus is now on an Australian media report that reported that a Chinese military scientist, in fact, had filed a vaccine patent as early, COVID vaccine patent, in fact, as early as February 2020. This was just few weeks after China had informed WHO of the COVID clusters in Wuhan, just 5 weeks, in fact, after that, a Chinese military scientist had filed for a vaccine patent. But what's more interesting is that after he filed for a vaccine patent in February, he was reported dead in May 2020 under mysterious circumstances. This Chinese scientist is now becoming another focus as far as Wuhan investigation is concerned. Our senior executive editor Abhishek is joining us live from the Delhi newsroom to give us more details about this report in the Australian media.
Okay, you heard something else just now. How long do you think it takes a scientist working in a lab with some new discovery to actually create a vaccine that is ready for marketing? A year? Year and a half? 2 years? Not a few weeks. That means then to any responsible and reasonable person that this person was working on this vaccine from this specific virus long before then. Which means to any responsible person that this was not just a gain of function research, but this was a bioweapon research. And we have evidence of that as well, because the head of the Chinese Defense Research Laboratory, with nearly 100 PhDs under him as his students, he was on record in a published paper in China that we have a copy of, that any journalist could get, of using this virus for weaponizing it and explaining why it would be beneficial to have this, because then you wouldn't have to be using troops. You could go in with a virus like this and destroy your enemy without having to fire a shot. That's in addition to all the cyber attacking. And yet the world would have us believe that we're all as naive as they would want us to be, to believe that there is nothing nefarious around the country, including at Fort Detrick in the United States, when we know that they've done gain-of-function research on pathogens for a long time, including on biological weapons, in violation of the international treaties to prevent that from happening. We have one more that I'll play from Australia, and you will not hear this kind of discussion in the American media.
By the day that this virus first leaked from a laboratory in China. And if true, China will be morally on the hook for trillions of dollars of compensation. First, there's this stunning coincidence. This pandemic started in Wuhan, right outside a lab. There, in that city, that was working on exactly such viruses, taken from bats and then engineered to make them more lethal to humans, apparently, so scientists could then work out a vaccine. What's more, this virus first appeared already perfectly adapted to killing humans with no sign of earlier strains. Then we learned that three workers at the same lab were taken to hospital just before the pandemic became public with virus-like symptoms, but China won't hand over the medical records of the earliest cases. And I've also told you that this virus had an unusual feature called the furin cleavage site that makes it more infectious, a feature you wouldn't actually expect to develop naturally. And now, even more decisive, is a report by two American experts, Stephen Kwai, a prominent biotech entrepreneur, and Richard Muller, a physics professor, that says that the amino acids that make up the genome of this virus that make it so dangerous are almost certainly man-made. Well, I'm joined by one of those authors, Stephen Kwai, who's briefed the US Congress on his research. Stephen Kwai, thank you so much for your time. Can you tell us, first of all, what did you find and how can you explain it in a way that non-scientists, unfortunately like me, can understand?
Well, it's a pleasure to be speaking to you. I mean, I think the simplest way to talk about it is you have a book, you're reading an English book and you're reading along very nicely. You turn the page and suddenly there are sentences in Attic Greek. So what we saw was that we saw the bat virus was using the bat virus language. And then suddenly there were two words that are only used really in the laboratory. And they stand out and they're right in the middle of the furin cleavage site. So we did some math. You can do a lot of calculations. It's probably 1 in a billion chance that it came from nature. But it's exactly the language that's used in the laboratory to do, as you said, gain of function research.
So these are two.
That goes on for 15 minutes, but it shows a scientist explaining why it could not have come from nature and why it had to come because of the proteins they're finding in it. These are stories that all lead in a direction, and yet Anthony Fauci, the head of the FDA, the head of the CDC, the president and his cabinet, are wanting us all to go in the other direction and not to ask questions, instead simply accept that only a vaccine or a drug is the answer. I will address all this now. The COVID-19 pandemic and the corruption of genuine science, Richard Gale and myself. Medical science has made such tremendous progress, there is hardly a healthy person left. Aldous Huxley. For half a century, the pharmaceutical industry has shown near zero tolerance towards criticism against its unequivocal failures and medical catastrophes. Permanent disabilities and deaths due to unsafe drugs, such as Merck's anti-inflammatory drug Vioxx, Pfizer's Bextra, synthetic hormone replacement therapy, thalidomide, and the earlier cellular pertussis and the 1976 influenza vaccines are regarded as the collateral damage of getting unsafe medical products on the market. During the past two decades, a tightly knit and collaborative relationship has evolved between the pharmaceutical industry, all of our federal health agencies, Congress, Silicon Valley, and the new culture of billionaire philanthropists such as Bill Gates. Due to the large web of funders favoring corporate financial interests and CDC-sponsored educational programs, the mainstream media is now the successful advertiser for pharmaceutical ambitions. As a consequence, modern medicine's dire risks to public health are undermined. The broader picture and the darker players operating behind the tragic legacy of medical iatrogenic failures remains largely hidden from the public. In recent years, those physicians, researchers, and health advocates who dissent from the pharmaceutical narrative often face a formidable blowback resulting in censorship and destroyed reputations. Over 40 years ago, the sociologist and philosopher Dr. Ivan Illich prophetically observed a conspicuous unfolding of modern medicine becoming divorced from itself and from the ethical basis for treating illnesses. He wrote, "The medical establishment has become a major threat to health." I interviewed Illich many times, and he had a profound understanding of what had gone wrong. Illich was among the first poignant critics of the corporatization of medicine to address the problems of medicalization, the process by which very human non-medical conditions are redefined as medical diseases and then diagnosed and pharmacologically treated as such. This has been a result of hardened scientific materialism's ascendancy as the final judge over national health care. Increasingly, researchers, more often than not funded by private drug companies and backed by an army of lobbyists, are discovering ways to reevaluate health conditions with only flimsy clinical evidence into the actual etiology of disease. Even infectious pandemics. Psychiatric practice, which today relies almost exclusively on a drug-based flawed model, is the greatest serial offender. Yet systemic corruption throughout our national health care has been a boon for drug makers who can then develop novel medications for illnesses that could otherwise be treated by less expensive and safer drugless or even natural therapies. Modern medicine is a negation of health, so said Illich. He wrote this in his acclaimed book, Medical Nemesis, The Expropriation of Health. He said, "It isn't organized to serve human health, but only itself as an institution. It makes more people sick than it heals. It is a system that today depends upon volumes of flawed medical clinical trials, financial incentives, institutional bureaucracy, revolving doors between government and private industry, rampant conflicts of interest, and an aggressive propaganda machine that has had enormous success in marginalizing and ridiculing critics both within and outside of the medical complex. Our medical edifice has violated every defining principle of scientific inquiry that should place uncompromising value on objective, unbiased inquiry and open conversation and debate over conflicting views. To invoke the precautionary principle is a personal confession of heresy. Over the years, the steady rise in the number of class action and criminal lawsuits against pharmaceutical firms, additionally the Freedom of Information Act submissions and false testimonies by federal health officials before congressional subcommittees have confirmed Illich's warnings. He was right. The entire medical edifice has been wrong. For Illich, the dangerous consequence is that conventional medicine has become depersonalized. Whereas in the past, malpractice was treated as a serious ethical issue, and iatrogenic death or fatalities due to medical error is now the U.S.'s third leading cause of mortality. It is simply perceived as, well, just a technical glitch that can be corrected by further technical solutions. After all, who's going to complain? On a given year, you might have anywhere from 500,000 to nearly a million individuals in the United States die because of iatrogenesis or medical problems. That would make it, in many cases, the number one killer that year, more than heart disease or stroke or cancer. And yet, when was the last time you heard of any committee of Congress or corporate America or the American Medical Association, or articles in New England Journal of Medicine, or The Lancet, or the British Medical Journal, discussing the failures of American medical paradigms, those which are failures, not all are, of course, and how they should be corrected, starting with medical school curriculum and teachings, so we don't just ensure another generation of medical doctors, even those with high ideals, which most have, using the wrong tools and ending up hurting or killing the patient. How about zero? As if that's not important. So it is not important to change a medical system that is causing enormous suffering and death. As a result of persistent self-denial over conventional medicine's inherent failures, the dominant medical paradigm that now governs the nation's health has succeeded in barricading itself behind a monolithic propaganda machine and a compliant media, and complicit in not seeking the truth, and hence marginalizing criticism, and to hermetically seal itself from being called to legal account. Even worse, it has usurped the sovereignty we have over our bodies and transferred this power to a technocracy that deeply believes it is upholding the integrity of science. Nothing could be further from the truth. However, it is a science solely molded in the image of medical bureaucrats and their powerful allies who have been christened as experts. And all of these past medical failures, the estimated 90% of junk pharmaceutical clinical trials published in junk mainstream medical journals, then reported in junk mainstream publications, and then reported ad nauseum by so-called junk experts on junk television. All this is institutional hubris, and the drug makers have captured our entire health agencies. And they're being openly staged in the handling of COVID-19 pandemic on the global theater. So we put the least competent, the most vile, the most rapacious in charge of our most serious public health issue today. What do you think the outcome will be? When we are being lectured to recite the pandemic mantra in unison by Joe Biden, Governor Andrew Cuomo, and the UK's Boris Johnson, and one of the Church of Scientism's head priests, Neil deGrasse Tyson, follow the science, they say, and I say, whose science is being referred to? Is it the 19th century mechanistic science, which continues to be the foundation for modern evolutionary biology, neuroscience, psychiatry, and vaccinology? Is it the pseudoscience propagated by the cult of skepticism that pollutes hundreds of Wikipedia health pages entries? Is it corporate, pharmaceutical-based science, medical research and discovery motivated by astronomical commercial incentives to appease the hedonic financial appetites of shareholders? For Anthony Fauci, he has imaged himself as the incarnation of science. Replying to MSNBC's Chuck Todd, Fauci made his self-proclamation, quote, "What you're seeing is a tax on me, quite frankly, are a tax on science." You think? Or is it science that is meticulously vetted by a range of independent professionals who aspire to arrive at the truth of a medical problem or to find a medical solution? Is it this latter group who are most inclined to impartially review the pros and cons of scientific papers, the clinical trials of a drug, vaccine, medical device, and diagnostic tool, then, based upon the empirical evidence of medical intervention's value, efficacy, and safety is properly determined? Sadly, this latter group is rarely, if ever, invited to sit at the regulatory table or to advise national health policy. Rather, the pursuit of medical facts about disease and pandemics has ceased to be an evidence-based methodology of objective inquiry and has become a means to institute authority and control over a population. You can't really follow the science, states the philosopher of science, Matthew Crawford. He said, because science doesn't lead anywhere. It can illuminate various courses of action, for example, by quantifying the risks that 10 to each. It can help to specify the trade-offs, but it cannot make the choices for us. Modern medicine's failure to recognize this has, in Crawford's opinion, led to, quote, the victimology joining hands with scientism. That is, medicine as an ideology and not as a science. The consequence is that those who question or challenge the dominant medical ideology are censored, canceled, and have their reputations destroyed. We must come to the conclusion that modern conventional medicine has lacked the enthusiasm to uncover scientific truths for many decades. The pandemic's mantra, follow the science, has been waxed into a meaningless banality. It is an empty, amoral platitude for bureaucrats and media pundits with MDs and PhDs decorating their names. Unlike the hard sciences, such as mathematics and physics, medical practice is soft. Medical certainty, as in the serious hard sciences, should have as its objective value-neutral truth. Medicine medical discovery is equally an art form. It is supposed to be grounded upon scientific evidence in order to make reasonable decisions. The debate over whether the practice of medicine is an art or an empirically based science has raged for decades. Over two decades ago, the British Medical Journal published an article entitled The Practice of Clinical Medicine as an Art and as a Science. The authors spread out on the table the prime principle to govern medical research as a determining factor for publication. Here's what they said. Scientific thinking must be insulated from all kinds of psychological, sociological, economic, political, moral, and ideological factors which tend to influence thought and life in society. Without those prescriptions, objective knowledge of truth will degenerate into prejudice and ideology. They were right then, they are right today. And yet, nothing about COVID-19, its approach, has been anything but this form of prejudice ideology. Unfortunately, none of the self-anointed captains now steering our global and government health agencies to confront SARS-CoV-2 pandemic and the deeply worrisome escalation of COVID-19 vaccine injuries and deaths has ever bothered to give this fundamental scientific axiom a moment's worth of reflection. Reported COVID-19 vaccine injuries and deaths in the CDC's own adverse events reporting system now dwarf those for all other vaccines during the past 20 years combined. The so-called experts, such as Anthony Fauci and the FDA's new commissioner, Janet Woodcock, a 35-year careerist at one of the most discredited, disreputable, and corrupt regulatory agencies, hold their high rank within the medical hierarchy and were appointed to these positions because they were seduced to sacrifice objective knowledge of truth in return for prestige, power, and wealth. They serve as the prejudiced and ideological protectors of authentic science's antithesis, the pharmaceutical industrial complex. We do not need to stretch too deep into Western medicine's history, back to the era of leeches, bloodletting, and exorcisms in the neurological disorders to find examples of medical consensus and treatments displaying humanity's sheer stupidity. We have continued to inherit this madness upon the 21st century, and during the pandemic, it blazes before our eyes. Unfortunately, too many Americans and citizens in other nations are blindly willing to surrender their faith and trust in medical experts, the latest drug or vaccine on the market, and the federal regulators who are mandated to assure that those medications and vaccines have been scrupulously reviewed to evaluate their safety and efficacy profiles. We assume that medical interventions are evidence-based. We believe they are founded upon scientifically sound and reliable observation, data collection, and analysis. Yet we only need to look at modern history to find many examples of Western medicine being categorically wrong, deadly so. In the 1940s through the 1970s, millions of Americans smoked. In some households, every adult smoked. Every physician who were viewed as the exemplars of health and knowledge, smoke regularly. Doctors would be featured on advertisements endorsing different cigarette brands. After a smoker reached 40, being diabetic, overweight, or having a cardiovascular illness and emphysema was considered, that's just normal. That's part of aging. Medical leaders assured us that this could not possibly be associated with smoking. They were believed because they were, of course, the experts. To speak out against cigarettes as the culprit behind these preventable conditions was taboo. Consequently, several generations of Americans suffered and died prematurely and needlessly because the scientific community accepted the nation's health officials in an unconditional way, and it was all false. It was a fraud. California State University bioethicist and author of The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine, Professor Limon McHenry, views the epidemic of bad medical research as similar to dirty money laundering. After reviewing thousands of clinical trial documents, he observed the means by which pharmaceutical companies intentionally designed flawed clinical trials favoring the drugs and vaccines, and hence generate dubious data and then wash it through a corrupt methodology to make the product look clean at the end of it all. During an interview, Professor McHenry said it was like throwing darts at a door and then later drawing a target on the door so the darts appear to have hit the bullseye. Drug makers have mastered these tricks, and our regulatory officials are consistently fooled and left none the wiser. For those who grew up in the great and baby boom generations, stress reduction was virtually unknown. Exercise was perceived as unnecessary after high school or college. A plant-based or vegetarian diet was viewed as extreme. The different iterations of the American food pyramids, starting with the Food for Young Children Guide in 1916 and leading up to the 1979 Daily Food Guide, suffered from a serious lack of knowledge and a misunderstanding about nutrition. There was little biomolecular understanding about the dangers of sugar and excess salt. Processed foods, preservatives, and chemical dyes were being completely ignored. The only dietary supplement that was widely recommended was iron and, to a lesser degree, vitamin C. Today, we can look back upon these national dietary standards as medieval. Yet, the horrendous lack of science that supported our unhealthy American lifestyle was part of a scheme to indoctrinate people, and it was successful. And private corporations profited exorbitantly by sustaining these illusions. In the 20th century alone, leading medical journals and government agencies would promote electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy, bariatric surgery, mercury amalgams for your teeth, and dental fluoride. Diethylspestrol, synthetic hormone replacement therapy, artificial sweeteners like saccharin and Monsanto's aspartame and cyclamates, vaccines, ethyl mercury. However, today researchers frequently publish research papers identifying the very serious health risks for these very same products, which earlier were supported by reams of fraudulent corporate-sponsored research to court regulators. But despite all the reliable scientific data, it has failed to rein in national health policies and to conduct the CDC, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the FDA in a way that lessens our health risks that all Americans are exposed to daily. It is now 15 months since the World Health Organization declared a pandemic on March 11th of last year. The mainstream media has followed in lockstep with the government's public relations narrative. It has lied about the reliability of the PCR test as a gold standard. Injuries and deaths from the Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer vaccines are either rejected or reframed as unfortunate anomalies. We may hear about the rare non-compromising study against the use of inexpensive COVID-19 treatments like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, but the many dozens of studies recommending these drugs are flatly ignored. That is not unintentional. Nor are our health officials telling us the truth about the adverse effects of prolonged mask wearing, social isolation, and quarantines. The vaccine safety profiles, the inflated numbers of COVID-19 cases and mortalities, and were proving expensive novel drugs shown to be questionably effective. For our WBA audience, we'll be saying goodbye in a moment. For everyone else, we'll go to the top of the show.
From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Biden has arrived in the United Kingdom for his first overseas trip since taking office. After meeting British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today, Biden will take part in the G7 leaders meeting in Cornwall and then head to the NATO summit in Brussels. He will end his trip in Geneva, where he will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a speech ahead of the G7 meeting, Biden will outline plans for the U.S. to donate 500 million COVID-19 vaccine doses around the globe over the next year, on top of 80 million doses he has already pledged by the end of this month. U.S. officials say Biden will also ask fellow G7 leaders to do the same. Anti-poverty group Oxfam welcomed the news but called 500 million doses a drop in the bucket. Oxfam joins other groups in calling for more to be done to increase global production of vaccines without the constraints of property rights. Biden has backed calls for a waiver of some vaccine intellectual property rights, but there is no international consensus of how to proceed. The Keystone XL pipeline is officially canceled. The developer of the controversial project announced Wednesday it is pulling the plug after the Biden administration revoked its permit in January. The Keystone XL pipeline was expected to carry 830,000 barrels per day of crude oil from the oil sand fields of Western Canada to Nebraska, but the project was delayed for the past 12 years due to opposition from U.S. landowners, Native American tribes, and environmentalists. The demise of XL comes as other North American pipelines, including Dakota Access and the Enbridge Line 3, face continued opposition from environmental groups. Prosecutors in Minnesota say 179 people were arrested and charged with trespassing after a mass civil disobedience action on Monday against Enbridge Line 3. Another 68 were cited and released for public nuisance and unlawful assembly. The Louisiana State Police, involved in the 2019 fatal arrest of Ronald Green, is now reportedly the subject of an internal investigation into whether troopers have repeatedly targeted and abused black drivers. The Associated Press reported today that four people familiar with the probe confirmed its existence. The investigation is focused on white officers with State Police Troop F, a notorious unit in northeastern Louisiana, whose officers have mislabeled body camera videos, turned off their cameras during arrests, and otherwise worked to hide evidence from investigators. Some of the troopers already face felony charges. The Texas Bar Association is investigating State Attorney General Ken Paxton to determine whether he committed professional misconduct in his failed effort to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. The State Bar of Texas will consider whether Paxton made false or misleading statements to a court or filed a frivolous lawsuit when he contested the election results of four other states, claiming that President Trump lost because of fraud. If the bar concludes that he did commit misconduct, Paxton could be disbarred, suspended, or receive some other kind of punishment. The U.S. passed a bill Wednesday to make the Pulse nightclub in Orlando a national memorial. The bill's passage comes just days before the fifth anniversary of the June 12, 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting that left 50 people dead and dozens were wounded. The bill passed the House in May and now heads to President Biden's desk for a signature. And in weather today, in Washington, D.C., it is 85 degrees, partly cloudy. In New York City, 80, mostly cloudy. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Stay tuned for Leonard Lopez at Large coming up. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.